I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this off from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show,
you may not only be able to hold your breath for 45 seconds to a minute, but because of the work you're doing, you're developing that tolerance with the CO2 at the higher levels so that you can actually absorb the oxygen a little bit better.
You're getting your oxygen levels high, and then you're going into a breath hold. And most people don't breathe enough consciously to calm themselves down.
You're teaching yourself. You actually have more control over your performance and what's happening than you typically ever thought you did. But the problem with that is that it actually does require work.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Mobility, balance. whatever it is for you that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and I gotta tell you, from things like power breathing to underwater workouts to Wim Hof style cold water immersion to these super sexy training masks and free diving and spearfishing and beyond, it seems that this concept of breath work and performance breathing is kind of taking the world by storm. So I figured it was high time that we actually addressed all things breathing in a podcast. So today we're going to take a deep dive with a guy who is an expert in performance breathing, and he's been on the show before, a long, long time ago. I interviewed this guy way back in podcast episode number 47 about CrossFit Endurance, because he is the creator of CrossFit Endurance, Brian McKenzie. Brian is with us today. He's a strength and conditioning expert. He wrote a bunch of good books. One that I recently read called Unbreakable Runner. Fantastic book. You should check it out if you get a chance. I'll link to it over in the show notes for today's episode, which you can grab at bengreenfieldfitness.com/performance breathing. So Brian works with runners, cyclists, rowers, MMA, surfing, paddling, swimming, CrossFit, Olympic gold medalists, world champions, you name it. So, Brian, welcome to the show, man.
Ben, thanks for having me.
Are you wearing a training mask right now?
No, I am not.
Okay, just checking. Just checking.
I prepped with one this morning before we did some breathing. We had a couple people over to do a little breathing this morning, and we kind of like to prep by using the training mask to trigger some things. So,
what do you mean? We had like for breakfast with your family, or
no? A couple days a week since we've gotten into this stuff with the Wim Hof and just a lot of the breathing stuff that we do. There's been a lot of people who've reached out, especially locally. And I just did a breathing performance camp that I actually had Wim kind of come in at, but I've taken a lot of the stuff and the concepts that he's had, and kind of, I've been messing with it for, you know, the last couple of years. That said, local people have kind of caught on, and it's always a better environment for people. Well, typically it's a better environment for people to do it in a group setting. So we offer up a mild group setting at our private facility here in Orange County.
Okay, so you've got like a studio in Orange County in LA where you train people how to do things like this performance breathing. Is it a gym?
Yeah, it is. It's an office. It's a gym. It's a 1,000-square-foot gym. We're probably going to move, but it's a private place. It's somewhere where I've been able to kind of bring a lot of the professional athletes that I work with so that they're not being bugged.
Yeah.
Because some of them can be pretty high level and it gets a little weird. And, you know, with that said, it's also a place that we can work out and we're not being bothered, or I'm not working out in a garage and the cops aren't being called.
Gotcha. The cops get called when you work out?
Yeah. My wife and I have had the entertaining thing here is that every time we've moved, we've worked out in our garage, and the police are typically called within the first few months, which is very typical of a gym anyway, at least a CrossFit style.
Why do they get called? Because I think you're running like a business.
It's the noise and the bouncing of the plates and whatever. And so the police
show just got to be more stealthy, man. You got to listen to audiobooks and lift light and soft things.
Yes, if that were.
Yeah. So anyways, I want to ask you a little bit about the kind of stuff that you teach in the performance breathing workshops that you do. But first, elephant in the room, get a bunch of questions about the training mask. And I talked recently on a podcast, and I linked to this study where it seemed to show that a big part of the mask is you rebreathing the carbon dioxide that you exhale like into that space inside the mask. And that's where a lot of the effect comes, is from you just like recycling your own carbon dioxide or something like that. I'm curious, when you get the question, you know, is that training mask thing just a craze, a fad? Does it actually work? What do you say?
Well, I say, yes, it does work. Maybe some of the original marketing on it might have not been as spot on, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't work. That said, I scoffed at this thing the first time I was handed one.
Well, I did too.
You know, and that's my, I've created a trigger in me that I've created over the last 15 years that if I'm going to scoff at something or I'm going to badmouth it, that if that's my reaction to it, then I've got a mechanism where I can stop before I actually, you know, allow myself to speak about that. And I'll be like, all right, it's time to learn. And so I'll set myself in motion with trying to understand something. So I put the mask on and I played around with it. And immediately the first thing I noticed was that I actually engaged my diaphragm in a deeper manner. And so I handed it to a few athletes and we had the exact same reaction and I changed and we saw changed breathing patterns.
So you mean you were doing like deeper belly breathing?
At 100%.
Yes. Do you think if you didn't know how to do deep belly breathing before you put it on that you would have done that?
If I had had the no, well, so here's the interesting thing is I have actually worked with people who actually do know how to belly breathe and use the diaphragm correctly. Yet the moment we put them into intensity, regardless of what that is, even if it's a 10K run, that breathing pattern changes. And there has been no athlete that I have really run into that actually knows how to breathe correctly. And The irony in that is that when we do breathe correctly, we're in a better position. And my career catapulted because I was a movement guy first, and I honed in on running and got popular with running mechanics, albeit I work with just about everything. The fact is that, you know, you breathe in a poor position, you're out of position and you're creating bad patterns. And so that was the biggest eye opener for me with this thing. So had I even known, I don't know that I necessarily would had I gone and tried to start working out, but I did start to figure out ways to utilize it in order to create changes that were lasting.
So it's just the diaphragm. Anything else, or is it all just muscle?
Well, no. You set the diet. I mean, what we want to ultimately see is the diaphragm works first. Then we start to lift through the chest. The rib cage opens up, and we have this big, you know, these balloons called lung correctly. Versus every athlete I run into is basically just breathing with their chest, and you can see their chest move immediately when they breathe. And it was a very big eye-opening experience for me.
Okay. Now, what about what's happening physiologically, like this whole carbon dioxide thing I was talking about? Do you or have you seen evidence that you get increased red blood cells or EPO or hematocrit or anything like that when you use a training mask?
I have not seen that. I don't know that it necessarily happens or it doesn't. And I don't necessarily talk about things that I don't quite know yet. I don't have the system to draw the blood work, but the fact is what we do know is that you are actually collecting CO2 inside the mask. And as negative as that may sound, that's actually not a negative thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, was about whether it creates like metabolic acidity or rebreathing your own carbon dioxide, you know, the health now, of that. Yeah,
yes, it can. But the interesting thing here is that as asthmatics start by being very CO2 intolerant, and that then creates an acidity and literally an autoimmune response that can go into a lot of other things. But the fact is they are very CO2 intolerant. And what we do with breath hold work is we're trying to make somebody more CO2 tolerant so that they can last longer on breath hold stuff. And there's a process, it being a competitive swimmer when I was younger, we would do breath hold work where we would not literally, we would not breathe for 3 strokes. Then it would be 5 strokes. And then we'd work out to 7 strokes. Then we'd work out to like 9, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you were developing this ability to adapt to the CO2 so that you could actually utilize oxygen more efficiently. That's what CO2's, if you don't utilize CO2 correctly, you actually don't absorb oxygen very well.
So you can actually increase your breath hold time by rebreathing CO2.
100%. Now, if you're doing it all day long, that's probably going to present a problem. Or if you're doing it for a long, long periods of time.
It'd be like doing hypoxia all day long.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So like small amounts are good for you, but you wouldn't want to do it all the time. Kind of like exercise too.
And we can see a change even within inside of a week with people where if we put them on a training mask and have them do a 10-minute warm-up and that's what they're doing every day, you know, we can see a change in a week. Of like, hey, there's some sort of physiological adaptation happening where they're not getting as claustrophobic. And that's what that feeling is.
Yeah.
Claustrophobic feeling that people get when they wear the training mask, that's the CO2. So that also happens when you go to hold your breath. And when your body says, hey, dude, you need to breathe. That's that claustrophobic feeling like, I got to breathe. That CO2 level's rising.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you ever taken one of these inside a sauna, like a training mask inside a sauna?
Yes.
Yeah, and done like a hardcore workout. So you've got double claustrophobia because you want to claw your way out of the heat and you're also wearing the mask.
Yes.
It's an incredible workout. Like if you go jump in a cold pool after something like that.
Well, yeah, that's probably the quickest way to kind of get back to normal.
Yeah. So what about when we're talking about this concept of holding on to CO2 and it increasing breath hold time? I'm studying for a free diving course right now. So in 2 weeks, yes. I'm going down to Fort Lauderdale for a week to dive. And yes. One of the things that my instructor sent me was a static apnea table, one for oxygen and one for CO2. Have you seen these?
No.
Okay. So the CO2 one, you'll do like 6 rounds of holding your breath for a minute. And then in between each round, you have decreasing rest intervals. So after the first time you hold your breath a minute, you'll rest 90 seconds. And then the next time you'll rest 60 seconds. And then the next time you'll rest 45 seconds. So apparently what it's doing is training your body how to get used to holding on to CO2 or being exposed to higher amounts of CO2.
Yeah.
And they've got the other one that he sent me is an oxygen table where you'll like hold your breath for an increasingly long period of time. Like you'll hold your breath for a minute, then a minute 30, then a minute 45, then 2 minutes. And in between each of those, you just breathe for 2 minutes. So rather than decreasing the rest intervals, you're just keeping the rest intervals constant and increasing the breath hold time.
Yes. Very aware of stuff like that. I've done a lot of work with that. You know, it's interesting because I work with a lot of big wave surfers. Like heavy duty guys that are, you know, needing to hold their breath for longer periods of time. And the interesting thing is that Laird Hamilton came up with some stuff 15 or so years ago on underwater training. And what he started to recognize was everybody was literally like trying to run a rock across the bottom of the ocean. And That was great, but then everybody started to gravitate towards the free diving thing where it's like, hey, I'm going to learn how to hold my breath and it's statically, like barely moving, not moving at all, and I'm going to increase my ability to hold my breath. And what we see are there are a ton of people in the free diving world that are dying all the time. The top people in the world.
Dying?
Dying.
From what?
From shallow water blackout.
Oh, and yeah. Okay.
Reason is what we've correlated this to is in the free diving world, what's happening or spearfishing world is you're coming down, you're getting to a deep depth, you're holding your breath, and you're very, very quiet. You're not doing anything. So
low CO2 levels and low oxygen levels. So when you're static and you're not moving around, it's really, really easy to get yourself to black out, which is shallow water blackout. So these guys are coming, they're 3 feet from the surface and they're passing out and dying. And what we've noticed is that whenever any work is being done in the water, that the CO2 levels raise so quickly, so high that your body's signaling, hey, I got to breathe. I got to breathe. So you go to get a breath and you're taking yourself, you're not taking yourself that limit where the oxygen levels are dipping too low because if CO2 levels are low and oxygen levels are low and you're in the water, you're going to go out. That's what lights out is. And so once that oxygen saturation level gets to a certain point, you go out. And if you've ever done any of the Wim Hof stuff, this is exactly the type of stuff you're doing, but you're not in the water.
You're loading with CO2 outside of the water, so your body gets used to that CO2-O2 imbalance?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And so it's very difficult as you rise, you know, why, you know, and this is why shallow water blackouts are happening. There was two Navy SEALs that just died recently, you know, and it's just, it's people doing breath work and not understanding how it works. And
so what these people should be doing is more CO2 work outside of the water.
Yes, absolutely. And or in the water. And so that's what we've seen actually with a lot of the training that we've done, like Laird and I have been doing, and Laird started this stuff, but we've come together in developing some program stuff that we're going to launch that, you know, big wave surfers aren't ever in an environment where it's a calm, static place. You know, a 50-foot wave drops on your head. That's not a calm place. That's like nature at its greatest, and you're having to make some serious decisions. And although you're being tossed around, it's not like a free dive moment. So this is where we're really starting to see a lot of the work that we're doing in the pool, where we have dumbbells and we're having working sets, is you may not only be able to hold your breath for 45 seconds to a minute, but because of the work you're doing, you're developing that tolerance with the CO2 at the higher levels so that you can actually absorb the oxygen a little bit better.
I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and Neil Strauss was there. I guess he's done some workouts with you guys, and he brought me into the pool and was showing me how to like put a dumbbell between my legs and swim underwater. Yes. Using just my hands on my back. And then I'd switch to my stomach to go back the other way, and then clutch it to my chest and go back the other way.
Yeah.
Is that the type of workout that you're referring to?
Those are called seahorses, or, you know, whatever we call them. But yes, it's very similar. But, you know, I could take a competitive swimmer and hand them a dumbbell and let them use one arm, and they're quickly going to become much more efficient at swimming. And I don't care how competitive they are. Getting a 50-pound dumbbell across a 50-foot pool is going to be a challenge in staying on the surface. And it's going to teach you about position as well. But holding that breath is going to teach you how to, you know, absorb that CO2 a little better as well.
Interesting. How often do you do these kind of workouts where you're getting in a pool with dumbbells and holding your breath?
2 to 3 days a week. I'm typically around the two. Laird's about three in the off season. And then we have another, you know, like gym type program and, you know, other stuff that he does as well. But a lot of these guys that we know, they're on the kind of the same program.
Interesting. Have you ever used one of these snorkels that you put on? And it's like a front mounted snorkel.
Yes.
That you swim with, but
yes.
It's made by Finisse, and it has what's called a cardio cap on top of it that restricts your airflow while you're swimming.
Ooh. Same concept as a training mask, except it's in the pool.
Have you ever used one of those?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very interesting. I kind of like it for that same type of effect that you're talking about when you just want to get a swim in. What other kind of devices do you use? Do you use like one of these power lungs or anything like that?
No, I've had one. I've had a power lung for years, and it can help develop a lot of this stuff, but there's nothing that the training mask is not developing with just taking the levels higher and higher and forcing you to get strong. Like everybody after this performance camp that I've been in touch with, this breathing performance camp, has literally said, dude, my abs are so sore right now. I'm like, yeah, you're using your abdominals and your diaphragm now.
Is that just from doing the workouts with the training mask?
I think it's primarily doing the stuff with the training mask, but what we're also doing is we're triggering. So we'll do a few sets with the training mask to trigger prior to doing even breathing sets with a lot of the WIM stuff.
Okay. Gotcha. So what would a typical workout wearing a training mask look like? Because when you get like the manual that comes with the mask, you're just kind of like, you know, lying on your back, bridging your hips up to the sky, and then coming back down and just kind of doing like really passive stuff. Are you guys doing full on like squats and rowing and swings, or are you just kind of doing like the more passive core work?
No, well, to start with the training mask or the breathing?
With the training mask on.
So with the training mask, what we'll do is I'll typically set somebody up on like an assault bike, which is like the old Airdyne, and it's just a better version of it. And
yeah, I was on one of those a couple of days ago. I went down to the Seal Fit thing.
Yes.
that Mark Devine does in Encinitas, and they had a bunch of those bikes out in the grinder. It's been a while since I've been on an assault bike, and those things are tough.
They're very tough, but it's a great thing that anybody can really do. And
you know, it's a full body deal. So we will typically set somebody up on that and have them start really easy with the training mask on. And then they'll go into sets of like 10 or 20 seconds hard and then 50 to 40 seconds easy.
And do you keep the mask on during the easy part? Or do you let it like
throughout this process? And we do about 10 minutes, some people 15, but it literally starts to, you see them breathing differently. And then we can take them off of that. And then it's, hey, we get into movement stuff. And if I see somebody who has some positional faults with things, I can easily hand them back the mask, have them hold, and let's just say a plank or the top of a push-up, and put the mask on. And all of a sudden, they automatically will change a position. And they'll find a solid hollow position that they can breathe in. And it's just an eye-opening experience for a coach, because as a coach, you're constantly trying to get on people about their movement patterns. And somebody who's looked at CrossFit as this amazing tool to screen athletic movement or any movement whatsoever, and seeing that, it's allowed me to make a lot of changes in people without having to like literally be on them. You know, and allowing them to see it themselves, the differences of what's happening.
Got it. Interesting. So these performance breathing clinics that you do, they start off kind of learning to breathe with the training mask. But aside from that, what other type of things are people learning when they go to a clinic like this?
So we'll show them best practices we've found with the training mask. We also show them the differences between what they naturally will do before we ever do anything. And I just say, hey, fill your lungs and empty your lungs. And I just want you to understand that process right now, not doing anything differently than you would. Then we show them the training mask and, you know, it's like, hey, can you replicate that without the mask on now? And they do. And they see the difference of how much more air they're actually drawing in. Then we will introduce some of the WIM stuff. Because the WIM stuff, from a performance standpoint, is when we're breathing, what typically happens when we're starting to get exhausted is we start to expel all this air that we have. And so we try and dump it all.
Okay, so we're like breathing out longer or more forcefully than we're breathing in?
Exactly.
Okay, and that would be a bad thing.
Well, that's a CO2 accumulation process. So you're going to accumulate more CO2 in that manner.
How would you accumulate more CO2 if you're breathing out more?
Because you're not taking in enough oxygen.
Okay, so when you say
bad air is kind of just sitting in there, and even though you're dumping it out, you're not only taking in very little oxygen, and so this will make sense in a second. But so we will take people and have them and teach them how to reverse that process, and by using the training mask to trigger the effect, then we can start to implement the breathing patterns, and we can show people during recoveries, okay, breathe how you normally would, don't do anything different. Now I'm going to trigger you how to breathe by forcing a big exhale or big inhale, mm-hmm. and not allow a full exhale to happen. So we only want to go about one atmosphere down, which is a half breath out, right? And then you're already drawing in another full breath again. And the recovery process in everybody tends to be almost double time, if not triple, with what they did prior.
Is that similar to the kind of breath protocol you'd go through prior to practicing, say, like a long breath hold?
Yes.
For example, you would breathe in pretty deeply and then breathe out not quite so deeply and do that for 1 or 2 minutes and then finish by breathing in as much as you can, holding, and then holding your breath for as long as possible.
Pretty similar, except we're more or less focused on the inhale and not so much the exhale. And it's just a constant. It's almost like you're going into this WIM breathing pattern as you are recovering between intervals. And so it's a forced large inhale and just a let go of the exhale, but you're trying to catch it about halfway out, and you just continue this process. Then we then take them into a steady state where we're going to have them learn how to just draw the breath in versus letting it out. So now that they've worked out a little bit and they're already kind of a little fatigued, then we can have them start to work out at a steady state that they know they can do right before they start to get acidic. you know, where right where it starts to get a little uncomfortable. And we mm-hmm. have pulled that, and then we have them implement the breathing protocol where they would draw in and not allow the exhale to happen as much. And we can trigger that as well with the training mask, so that the training mask can set up the pattern again, because you will automatically draw in more air on that training mask.
Yeah.
You know,
that makes sense, because when you're wearing that mask and you're exercising, because honestly, it's almost every day that I'll put it on at some point during a workout or a sauna session, you don't exhale quite as much, because it's just it's almost a little bit uncomfortable. It's more difficult to exhale than it is to inhale.
Correct.
Interesting. I never really thought about what was going on there, but it makes sense now. So when you're doing these kind of breath protocols, are you focusing on any difference in breathing through the nose versus breathing through the mouth?
Well, there's always going to be a transition. That transition's like right about at your aerobic threshold, where you can no longer use your nose and you have to turn over to mouth breathing. Then it just stays mouth breathing the entire time. But the fact is we can get people to go from literally feeling acidic, or the accumulation of acidity, where that's that limiting factor in how much harder they're going to go, to starting the breathing and it literally just starts to disappear. So they literally raise the alkalinity of the body as they're working.
Yeah, there's
performance change immediately.
There's this concept that when you're breathing through your mouth, and especially when it's shallow chest breathing, that you get more of a cortisol release, that you get more of these baroreceptors in the chest apparently become activated and cause cortisol to get released, and you get more of a sympathetic nervous system stimulation, versus like if you're breathing through your nose and getting more of like a parasympathetic nervous system stimulation. And I've tried that before during, you know, say like a strength training workout, to just breathe through the nose. I don't know if you've ever tried this, like just to like do a whole workout breathing through the nose.
Yes.
And then I was talking to a guy. He's a guy who works for Spartan, so he's always studying like what the Spartans do. This guy named Joe DiStefano, and he was telling me how these young Spartan athletes, these kids, they used to have them go for runs, and they'd have to swallow, or not swallow, but like put a certain amount of measured water in their mouth. And at the end of the run, like at the end of a 3-mile run, they had to hold the water in their mouth the whole time. They had to spit the water out at the very end and show that they had that same amount of water in their mouth. So the whole time they had to breathe through their nose. Have you ever tried something like that? Like a just a run where you're just breathing through your nose, or a weightlifting session where you're just breathing through your nose?
Yes. And one of the better moments of that was Kelly Starrett and I had to retake our level ones for CrossFit. And we did it over a course of a weekend about 6 or 9 months ago. And one of the workouts they had us do was like this thruster burpee workout. And he and I, we'd been toying with a lot of this stuff for a while. And he quickly said, okay, you can only work when you're breathing through your nose. If you have to breathe through your mouth, you have to stop.
Mm.
And so the whole workout, and the irony of this is, I went the first round and I was only breathing through my nose, and I only went hard enough to breathe to keep that, you know, so that I didn't go over that. And I finished third in a workout that I should not have finished third at. I was definitely not the fittest guy anywhere near that fitness level in that group. You know, there were definitely fitter people, but the interesting thing is that it gets you to control things that you typically will not control.
Yeah. It's really interesting. You almost go into like this meditative state.
100%. And that's what the breathing's doing as well, even like with the WIM stuff, or even the stuff we're actually teaching people how to use them for performance. And the fact is you're getting into the autonomic nervous system, where you're starting to control things, where you're not letting the subconscious ride everything. You're consciously overriding it.
Yeah.
So you're teaching yourself that you actually have more control over your performance and what's happening than you typically ever thought you did. But the problem with that is that it actually does require work. It actually does require a learning pattern. But the fastest way to that I have found is using the training mask.
Yeah, it requires a ton of focus too. Like,
yes.
Like you'll catch yourself. It's almost like a leash, right? Like, for example, if I've got an easy recovery day and I'm going to go on a bike ride, I'll tell myself, all right, keep your mouth closed, frigging only breathe through your nose. And it keeps you, it's very hard to go past, you know, that threshold you were just talking about, like that threshold of acidity.
Yep.
It's hard to do that unless you're breathing through your mouth, because your body just wants to, you know, like take in all this oxygen. And when you tell yourself, okay, nose breathe only, pal, it holds you back in kind of a cool way.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. So, have you seen this thing that, you know, there was a guy who wrote a book, John Duyard. He's a coach out of Boulder, Colorado. And in his book, which is all based on Ayurvedic medicine and deep nasal breathing while you're exercising, he recommends these breath right strips that you wear around your nose to keep your nasal cavities open when you're doing nasal breathing. But now there's this thing called the turbine. Have you seen this?
Yes, I've used the turbine.
What do you think of that?
Love it.
Really?
Yeah, for somebody that has like a deviated septum, I mean, I broke my nose a few times. I played water polo for quite some time and had my nose busted. And so I've been a mouth breather for a lot of my life.
Really? You played water polo?
Yeah.
What position did you play?
I guarded 2 meters and I was a driver.
Okay, cool. I played whole set.
Yeah.
Yeah,
nice. So I literally was just like, I was just this mouth breather for a lot of my life. And then using the first nasal strips that everybody used to wear, I thought it was a brilliant move. But, you know, you got this sticky crap on your nose. You've got to take them off in the morning or whenever you take them off. Sometimes when you're working out, the sweat gets in the way because the sweat changes everything and the sticky thing comes off. And then I was at this... I was at some convention with Laird and Gabby Reese, and this guy came over and said, "Hey, you want to try these out?" And so I looked at it and I was like, "This is kind of a smart idea." And so I put it in, went for a ride, and I was like, I just literally worked. I did the same ride I did last week, and I felt like I worked so much less, and I was actually like 2 minutes faster on the ride.
Yeah, it's really, well, the winner of the Tour de France used one, Chris Froome.
Yeah.
He used one of these turbines. I'll put a link to these in the show notes, just theturbine.com. But yeah, it's this thing that you put in your nose. Yep. I wanted to ask you, Brian, kind of going in a different direction from nasal breathing and like hypoxia to hyperoxia.
Yeah.
Like these hyperbaric chambers or the, it's an intermittent style of breathing where you'll use like a mask connected to an oxygen tank and you'll breathe oxygenated air for a certain period of time and then take a break and then go back to the oxygenated air with exercise. It's called like intermittent hyperoxic training with exercise or something like that, or exercise. Yeah. I remember what it's called. It's exercise with oxygen therapy, EWAT. Have you ever done that? Do you use these type of things in your performance breathing courses, or what's your take on hyperoxia?
I don't use it in my breathing courses. We have an oxygen concentrator. We have been working with a guy who runs the exercise phys department out of Florida A&M. His name is Dr. Brian Hickey, and he is a pioneer in hyperoxia training. And we have found that proper hyperoxia training will help develop mitochondria and type 2A muscle fibers. So,
really?
Yeah.
So for the folks listening, what exactly would that mean? What would the implications of that be?
So think about it like this. I can take you up to your, you know, 90% of your max heart rate, and you're going to feel like you're working pretty damn hard for most people, right? If I put you on an oxygen concentrator, that's going to probably feel like your aerobic threshold. It's not going to feel like what you're doing. And so I can have you there for about 30 minutes, and then we can get you to recover off of that. And we use a heart rate recovery system with it, which helps the process. I've had a number of athletes doing it, and it's a pretty interesting process, but it takes about 16 workouts or so of doing it. And there's various ways of doing it. You could do it with even 1 minute max effort intervals, things like that. But what we're trying to do is get you to a maximum, just submaximal to maximal effort on a higher dosage of oxygen, typically around 90%. So that will allow the body to start to convert those mitochondria. It'll start to grow the mitochondria on with the type 2A muscle fibers.
Interesting. So it's almost like you have more oxygen available, so your body wants to build new mitochondria to do something with all that extra oxygen.
You got it.
Interesting. See, what I've always seen in the past, because I know there was a study last year in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research on hyperoxia, but it was all just recovery, right? So they'd like get exposed to hyperoxia and they'd recover faster.
And it makes sense, and it does, and you will. Yeah. But if you don't have that with you, you know, you're not going to, it's going to be a little bit more difficult. But the fact is if we get you working on stuff like that, then we can actually work for that change. We can actually work for that change sometimes without the oxygen, but this is also where the WHIM breathing comes into effect, because with WHIM stuff, you're alkalining the system and getting high levels of O2 and low levels of CO2. Which is allowing for you to get deep into the nervous system and do a lot of this stuff. And a lot of it right now is speculative, but he is convinced, and he's having a shit ton of university work being done, including at Harvard right now. But I mean, I've got a guy by the name of Dr. Andy Galpin out at Cal State Fullerton, who I turned on to this stuff, and he's going ape shit over it. And so he's starting to launch into some study work and some research work that is going to just spearhead a lot of the stuff that we've kind of figured out.
So there's this concept of power breathing, you know, like Tony Robbins does. And I think it's also called warrior breathing or fire breathing, where it's like, and I've heard some people say it increases CO2, which vasodilates and drives more blood into capillaries. I've heard some people say, no, it increases oxygen. Have you experimented with that style of breathing at all, or know exactly what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what's going on. It's similar. You know, a lot of people, like I had a meeting with Stephen Kotler about a week and a half ago, and we had discussed a lot of this stuff as he's tried to figure out breathing methods for himself. And he's like, oh, so this stuff is kind of like fire breathing. I'm like, yeah, a little bit, but not really. And so I've played around with the fire breathing stuff and warrior breath. And I think any route you go that's going to allow you to become more conscious of what's going on is a great route. But I don't know that it's necessarily doing all the things that they think it's doing. But, you know, I don't know that all the stuff I'm doing is doing the things that we think it's doing.
Yeah, I tell you what, man, I've used that before when I've been stuck in a corral before a race, when you can't warm up and you're waiting for the race to start, like a Spartan race or a 5K. Yes. And it's a great way to actually keep, you know, when you the first 2 minutes or so of any race just sucks, right? You're sucking air and everything's burning and you feel almost like stale for those first couple of minutes. This seems to make a lot of that go away. But yeah, I'll just do that deep. And there's a professional Ironman triathlete. You could probably find the video on YouTube somewhere, named Andy Potts. And the first time I started thinking about doing this was he was talking about how when all the other athletes are warming up in the water, he'll be off to the side in his wetsuit doing this deep power breathing. And then he'll end with like a full on exhale and a full on inhale and go through like three cycles of that just to warm up for a race.
And he's on to something.
Yeah.
Irony here is that you figured out my wife, before she would start a race, she would do this breathing to calm herself down so that she just didn't, like, she wasn't being overtaken by, you know, hey, I'm in an Olympic gold medal match right now, whatever, that she was calm. I've done some work with some special forces units, and they have protocols for doing some breathing prior to, you know, if something starts to get a little shitty. You know, a lot of people are catching on to little facets of this thing. But, you know, I think it really gets into, if you can really start to understand the stuff that where we're going, that this is going to be this is a very big performance enhancing product.
Yeah.
It's just breathing and understanding all of this stuff is paramount.
I keep the other thing I'll do before races is I keep one of these power lungs in the glove box of the car or in my travel bag, and I'll just do reps on that as I'm driving to the race to warm up my lungs, just because frankly a training mask makes you look silly when you're driving.
Yes.
But these power lung devices that you just hold up and wrap your mouth around and do like resist it out, resist it in, seem to work pretty well also, just for warming up the muscles prior to a race.
Yeah.
Now, let's say that folks wanted to increase their breath hold time. Yep. As far as like low hanging fruit, in yes. addition to some of the stuff you've talked about already, right? Like using a training mask, focusing on the inhale more than the exhale, et cetera. What are some other techniques that you would use for someone to increase their breath hold time?
The simplest is something like repeating a 2-minute breathing pattern of like a 3-second breath hold up top, a 10-second let out, a 3-second breath hold on the bottom, and then a large draw inhale. And you don't have to worry about how long the inhale is. Just take in a nice big inhale and repeat that process for 2 minutes and start with like maybe a 1-minute breath hold for 5 or 6 rounds of doing that.
That sounds almost like box breathing.
It's very similar. And you can use, and these are like, so it's just setting a pattern, and what you're doing is calming yourself down. You're getting your oxygen levels high, and then you're going into a breath hold. And most people don't breathe enough consciously to calm themselves down. Anybody who has really done any, like where they've studied them, they're like, my God, this guy can drop his heart rate and raise it, you know, in the blink of an eye. It's all breath work. It's literally being able to control your breathing and slow yourself down. And the closer the connection you have with like that vagus nerve, the easier it is for you to calm yourself down and then take in a large breath and begin that breath hold process. It doesn't matter what the pattern really is, other than a controlled exhale, because we just don't want to dump all that air out quite yet and get the body ready to draw in a big inhale. So it's just a control out, and you can do things. You could change that up. I think Outside Magazine did something not too long ago that was with a free diver guy that was like a SEAL or something. And he did some very similar stuff, and it's all doable things. And from there, it's like, hey, spend a couple weeks doing that. Then do that same pattern for 2 minutes and then walk and hold your breath. And now you're going to start to know what it's like to work a little bit more and hold your breath.
Walking breath holds. Those are actually real. I'll do those sometimes when I'm walking through the airport or I'm just doing something and I want to double up. Walking breath holds, where you'll just hold your breath for as long as you can and then recover. And you can do this on a walk. It's crazy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, you've talked a lot about Wim Hof. His name has come up a couple of times. Do you do this? Do you do the cold soaks and things like that?
Oh yeah, 100%. I've been doing this stuff for quite some time. I actually reached out to his camp about a year ago. We've connected. He came out and spent a week with us, up between Laird's place and my place. It looks like we're going to probably do a lot of stuff together, as he's really going to spearhead a lot of the disease and the work that he's really, really passionate about in helping kids and things like that. So I would not have ever reached meditation or anything close to it had I not actually found what he does. And I think that's a big, big thing, especially for people who are kind of performance junkies or type A personalities who don't really find a 20-minute, you know, or 30-minute or whatever, sit down, try and find Zen process attractive. I think his method allows people to find that place, you know, and I've heard it time and time again from people. But the fact is I know people who've been meditating 20 years and they've never reached the stages of meditation that we can get them to in less than, you know, in less than 3 minutes.
Interesting.
With this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I like his stuff. I was just curious if you do much of the cold therapy.
Yes.
Sounds like you're very on board with that.
Maybe had 4 or 5 warm showers in the last year. You know, we cold shower, I do ice, at least twice, if not 3 times a week. That's actually a performance changer as well. And contrary to popular belief or pop culture, you know, you want a quick performance enhancement, do an ice bath before you can actually compete at something.
Yeah, man after my heart. I like it. That was actually my workout this morning, was infrared sauna and cold soak. So I'm curious, I've got another question for you here. I know we're getting towards the end of our interview, but I wanted to ask you about quantifying some of this stuff.
Yeah.
There are obviously like fingertip pulse oximeters that you can use to track your blood oxygenation. There's heart rate variability measurements to track, you know, parasympathetic nervous system activation. Do you in your clinics or for yourself use any type of self-quantification to see what's working?
I do from time to time. My game is, you know, there's a great book out there and you probably read it. It's called Deep Survival.
Mm-hmm. And,
you know, Lawrence Gonzalez, I think this is one of the most important books of our time because it nails what human beings are in the fact that we think we know what we believe, but the fact is we only know what we feel. And if you can't feel it, then you don't know it. And we would love to believe, like, you know, that we know so much more than we do, but we're just like we look at things from a surface area, and a lot of the research that we do has been, you know, a lot of it gets tainted because it's funded or, you know, and a certain person's paying for it. And if it didn't work out, it's not coming to light. And, you know, not all of us or not everybody knows how to read the research. But the fact is, you know, you can even talk to a lot of the guys I work with who are PhDs. Like, they're like, look, we're 10 years behind where you're at, dude. Like, literally. I mean, I work with people at NASA, you know, and one of my colleagues is a kid who's a robotics engineer out of NASA. And it's like they are eons behind where we've been and what most of us are doing. People who are listening to this podcast, like, they are ahead of where the big money is and where everything's at. And yet we look at things like this and we look to things like NASA and the government or even, you know, big money that, oh, they're going to have the solution for a lot of this stuff. And they don't, you know. There's a book that took me about 20 years to read called A Brief History of Time. Stephen Hawking wrote it. And I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a couple of pieces in there. And this has been part of a lot of conversations that I've had, especially with my colleague from NASA. You know, Hawking laid out, simply put, it ever since the dawn of civilization, people have not been content to see events unconnected or inexplicable. You know, if everything in the universe depends on everything else in a fundamental way, it might be impossible to get close to a full solution by investigating parts of the problem in isolation. And this is the problem with what we do, because we try to isolate things and think of them like that. Now, we certainly have catapulted ourselves very far by isolating certain things and looking at them and trying to understand them. But I think that the fact is from a natural standpoint, we just don't look at things in the way nature kind of does them. I mean, why do we look at like a cheetah, you know, running 60 miles an hour, like this unbelievable thing, you know, and a cheetah from my understanding, literally only sprints every 3 days.
Yeah.
Yet we're training how hard to do what, you know? What is it a cheetah's doing that we're not doing? What is it a lion's doing we're not doing? What is it an elephant's doing that we're not doing? Like, what? Why don't we start to look at things from a bigger universal standpoint and how a lot of things are already working?
It's the human factor. I mean, a big part of it is the human factor, right? Like, I don't know about you, but like after a day of computer work and blogging and being inside, like, I want to go and freaking like lay down a hardcore workout out in the trails. And, you know, in some cases it's just escape, right? Like, it's running from something. And you don't see animals doing that a lot, but it's like that book about why zebras don't have ulcers, right? Like, they don't put themselves in situations where they necessarily feel compelled to go and use exercise and breath work and things like this to manage stress.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yet one of the ironies about the working out and all that stuff. And this is, you know, back when I was doing ultra marathons, you know, I had these massive, massive, like, spiritual moments that I would have when I was ultra running. And I was like, God, it's gotta be the pain and the suffering that I'm going through. And yet you talk to enough people. And, you know, I've had my wife and I get pretty deep, and she has these epiphanies as well when she's training. And I'm sure you've had these things, and people talk about runner's high and all that. Well, you know, one of the questions that I'm asking now is, it's like, well, is there any irony in the fact that you've been huffing oxygen at a level that you never had, that you were not doing before, and you've been out there long enough that you're finally getting to this place where you're almost like alkaline to a large degree, to where the body can enter into this, you know, the pineal gland, or even this place where you typically can't get to unless you're in REM cycle sleep, or, you know, all this stuff, which inevitably involves a lot of different breathing patterns.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I've been taking a lot of notes as you're talking, Brian, and I've put them all for those of you listening in over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/performance breathing. You can go check out Brian's website. If you're down around his area, check out his performance clinics. I'll link to his books as well, and some of these things like the turbine and the training mask and some of these other little toys that you can check out. So, Brian, thanks for coming on the show and sharing this stuff with us, man.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's fascinating. I'll let you go strap your training mask on and go run around naked in your ice bath or whatever it is.
I'm going to go surf. Next for you. I can last about a half day in the office before I have to get out.
Yeah, seriously. All right, man. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. And for those of you listening in, again, you can visit bengreenfieldfitness.com/performance breathing. And until next time, this is Ben Greenfield and Brian McKenzie signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.